Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Yes, I am the Director of Communications at the Alumni Association. I don't want to take up too much time introducing Professor Saracini. Just as you'll tell from my accent, just a short Irish story. I met him first 5 years ago. I was visiting family in Ireland and flew down to Florence with my son Samuel to write a feature article on Mr. Maracini for the UCSD Alumni Magazine. I was immediately impressed. To me, there is only one word that describes Maurizio, and that is impassioned. He is impassioned in his search for truth in art. Is it a fake? Is it real? And please, if it is real, let's do what we can to preserve it. Let's find out what is there, and let's preserve it. The second day that we were there in Florence, we walked into the city center for a latte. We passed a skip filled with building debris. Obviously, a developer was ripping out the inside of a building. Maurizio stopped and pulled out some pieces of plaster. It was painted blue. "This is a Renaissance blue," he said, and he was obviously angry. There were no builders around, so he took out his cell phone, photographed it, and sent it to City Hall with the number of the building. Impassioned. In the years since that article, he has been featured in newspapers around the globe, mentioned in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, had a documentary about his work on British television, and been the subject on 60 Minutes. He is now with us at UC San Diego, where he is the director of CISA 3, the Center of Interdisciplinary Science for Art, Architecture, and Archaeology. I'm happy to introduce my friend, Maurizio Saracini.
So I guess this is probably the best beginning. Way back then, as you can see, I had more hair, and I dye my hair in dark brown, as I used to be at that time, the fashion. And actually, it was a great honor. I was a scared kid, I was very proud. And I surely did not know that where I was heading, other than I got interested in just too many fields. And I remember the dean of the engineering school said, good thing that we have only one Italian on campus at that time, because I was just going everywhere. And he was getting sort of, not angry, but sort of worried, because always he was checking what I was doing, what I was studying. And when he heard that I wanted to study art history, he said, "What?" You know, and I wanted to study art history at UCLA. And then he lost his hopes in me and said, "Do whatever you want." And it doesn't make much sense to me. I do want to become an engineer, yes, but I also would like to study art history, history of architecture. And he said, "But make up your mind." So it was interesting experience for me, I must say. But I was free. I felt free, and I felt that I was getting a lot, and I was getting a way to expose myself to curiosity, to learning process, by the way. And I was having great guides, great professors, and later on, I'll go back to this thinking, and what I've been trying to follow are really the steps and the ways that I've been taught by some of the founding fathers of UCSD, who were also my professors. Well, several years later, as was mentioned, I managed to come back here. Incidentally, thanks to Raymond, and thanks to his his enthusiasm for me. I hope I deserve his friendship, but truly it was going back in the past, if you want, but really taking up the chance to come back here and to bring, I don't want to say the legacy, but at least everything that I learned in over 30 years of doing a very unusual work, trying to be an engineer, but in the field of arts and humanities. And I said, well, it cannot be harder that I went through in Italy were just trying to enter a museum and say, as an engineer, do you need me or some science to improve the conservation of works of art? And as you can imagine, how many doors were shut. And it took me a long time before they got the message, and they allowed me to start working. And there, and from that moment on, it was a sort of an avalanche, and I just went just about everywhere to study as much as I could, all major masterpieces and monuments. And so I came to a point where I said, well, where I'm going to be and what I'm going to do. I was dyeing my hair this time in white, so I had to think about what I was going to do after. And I could not continue doing like this. I wanted to pass it on. And I was so glad when Raymond really gave me this chance and to call me here and to give a talk. And I had a chance, a great chance, as always I had at this university, to express my ideas. And I just threw it out. And I said, here I am. I have this idea. Why don't we put together art and science, blend it together, and we create a new field and especially a new profession. And here is CISA 3 after a couple of years since that conference. And thanks to great people like the Dean of School of Engineering, the Dean of Arts and Humanities, and Calliope 2, we created CISA 3. The name is probably not the best in the world, but I could not find a better one, so for now it will stay. But basically, what is important is the people they're in. Great people. You see here Professor Kuster, Professor Levy, Tom Levy, and then Albert Lin, another young scientist who joined us with great enthusiasm and great passion, and we'll see later how much we have been developing together. We're really picking up momentum. I mean it. I can see how more students are being attracted by what we are doing, and I'm proud to say that we are also coming up with solutions, technologies, applications, methodologies that are badly needed, but yet, so far, you cannot find it anywhere else. So, you can see the mission is really, very briefly, is to apply interdisciplinary knowledge and prototype technologies for the preservation of cultural treasures worldwide, while serving as a unique training ground, because that's what we are doing, for a new generation of scholars and engineers of cultural heritage. And as such, the mission is unique. And some of the projects, some of this we'll go through very briefly, searching for the Leonardo da Vinci mural, the digital reconstruction of Palazzo Medici, where we have an incredible permission, let me say, to study the house, the very house of the Medici, who actually were the ones who made the Renaissance happening. And then the idea of the digital clinical chart. Nothing new. I come from the medical field, and we consider works of art patients, so why not develop a clinical chart idea? Never done before. You will never find a museum where there is a clinical chart, where the idea that each patient should be considered such as a work of art, and therefore collect all the know-how and to improve our knowledge, to follow through and check the state of conservation in time, develop the proper technology. That simply is not done yet. So, and then search for the King Solomon mines and search for the tomb of Genghis Khan. So these are just some, not all, but the major one. So, but not only I have the privilege to work with such great people, but also we have great stuff. We really have excellent students, and obviously no surprise. And it's like still a small family, but believe me, it's growing fast. And it's growing thanks to the support of the community that we are exposing ourselves, and rightly so. Just we want to invite all of you and more to come to see what we are doing, because what we are doing is not just for us. as for the culture, as for our culture, as is written, for to create a future of our for our past. Now, let's get into immediately the subject. And let's start with a nice lady that we all know. We think we know her, but I bet that we don't know her at all. And soon enough, well, a different understanding will come out. But for the time being, let's take a peer inside this lady. I hope she doesn't mind, but she has been sitting there nice and easy. And so we go to the Louvre. Millions of people go to the Louvre to see this lady. But do we really see her the way we should? Well, how about if we were to see her with her makeup on? Because that's exactly what we're going to see now. Now, that is what is sitting on her face. Not very good makeup, I should say. But this is really what we are looking at. Now, so when we go and see this lady, we see the colors. Let's not be too excited about it, because those colors are being sort of diffused by a lot of stuff that is sitting on it. Oxidized varnishes, repaints, restorations, decay processes. It's all sitting there. So at least we should not be too much concerned about the color rendering, the effect of the chromaticity that we perceive with our eyes. And that's not all. Now, what about if we were to go inner, see a little deeper? And we might, at this point, see a different lady. Now, if we're using, instead of ultraviolet light, this time infrared rays, well, we go through all that stuff that is sitting on it, but also we go through most of the paint layer, and we uncover features that otherwise we are not able to see, such as you might see the profile of the shoulders, as well as the armchair here, which is absolutely not visible to the naked eye, as well as, again, we see the hand, the left hand, which bears six fingers, because the Leonardo just changed the position of one finger. And so that gives you an idea that how much he has been processing through with this, the making of the of this beautiful lady. And then something has changed sometime in the past, so that some retouches and repaint was done on the right cheek. But most interesting, I'd like you to point at the background. Now look, on the left-hand side here, you see water, right? And you see water also up here, but you see it is water going through the river here with a bridge. Well, but here you just have landscape. See that? Well, actually the water originally spread through the whole valley here. This is also water. This is water over here. Some water is up here. And where is the bridge? It's actually, it's supposed to be here, but it's not here. So the bridge is a second addition in the sense that changes have occurred. So let's not take everything by the book, because there is a development history here that we can unveil. But definitely, as you can see, the background, but also some features of the lady as well, have been changed. Or at least they were changed initially, and then they were made the way you see it now. But let's make it just sharper. This time, instead of using a longer wavelength, we shorten the wavelength, still in the infrared band, and now look how clearly you see the water on the right-hand side. See here? So, indeed, the landscape was different. So let's not take everything for granted. Let's not consider an untouchable icon. Let's not consider that there is no history, no development. This lady still has a lot of surprises, a lot of, let's say, history that has not been revealed yet. Now, this sort of a strange-looking red image is made with pseudo-color infrared. And the red is the pseudo-coloring that is associated to the presence of lapis lazuli. It's a blue, very precious blue, and you can see it everywhere here. And that means that he used lapis lazuli everywhere. But look, again, it's clearly enough that the water, it's also here, the same blue, okay, which turns red in the pseudocolor infrared. But look up here. There's no blue. There's no red there. But yet, it's still water. So how come? Because that part of the water was painted with azurite, that with pseudocolor infrared does not turn into red. So now you have a different landscape, and oddly enough, you have only one part of the water painted with a different blue. Then again, that opens up questions. Was that a repaint? Was that done later? How come you would use, just on a short area like this, two blues just to for water? That's one of the many questions and answers, and we keep working on this lady, and probably, who knows, maybe by the end of the year we'll have some real surprises. But that's enough for now. All right, now let's go to see another very beautiful lady, and let's see how they can make it ugly, or at least, no, that's not fair to say, how they can make it look not as beautiful if they restore it as all restorers do worldwide, using what? Their hands. And you say, why? What's wrong with using hands to restore? Well, it depends. Today, in medicine, an eye surgeon hardly would use his hands holding a scalpel. Why? Because he's dealing with very few microns. What do you think a single layer of paint is all about? Few microns. So how do you think that your eyes and your hands can be good enough to clean up, to take away what has been added, what has been repainted? The risk is high that you could make a mistake, that your hand could not be so sensitive, so to speak. Your eyes could not be so good to guide your hands. But that's what is being done worldwide. Can you imagine a surgeon by himself in a surgery room just using scalpel? He would not be allowed to do that. Why? Because he could run into a lot of problems and mostly could actually kill the patient. So now let's go to the point. And you see the face of the primavera, okay? The face of the spring. All right, let's see the face of the spring in a different way. This is before it was restored. And you have here all this greenish gray, that's all the varnish and some restoration on top, okay? It makes it look this color when you shine a UV light on it. That was before restoration, done in 1980. I was there, and I had the privilege to study this lady. Now let's see the face after it was clean. And here you have the lady, and follow the pointer. These areas here, these bluish, gray, bluish areas, that's the fluorescence of the priming of the preparation layer underneath, which means that part of the color of the flesh is gone. Let me show it in another way, so you can see it better. Now, that doesn't mean that the restorers were not good enough. It means that your hands simply are humans, human hands. Look, this is before, and all these areas here is where too much cleaning went on. You don't see that with your eyes. That's using UV fluorescence. You can document it. I'm not talking about scraping off a lot of stuff. It's enough. This is such a subtle, thin layer of flesh, few microns. There's no way that your hands with a scalpel can have that precision. It's impossible for a human hand. But that's what is being done worldwide. So maybe science has to move in. Science has to provide the right tools, has to provide the right way to check what the restorers are doing. Well, aren't we simply saying that it should become a restoration room, a surgery room, a teamwork? Yes. I hope one day I will see that, especially when you have to put your hands on the Primavera or the Last Supper or the Sistine Chapel, and I go on and on and on. Because what you see today after the restoration is the interpretation of the restorer to his best knowledge, obviously. So that's to give you an idea how much work needs to be done to provide high precision and probably not your hands if you want to do a real job. Let's see. Now let's use x-rays to see underneath the same painting, x-ray twice. The first time in 1983, the second in 2001. I x-rayed that because in 2001, this painting showed was placed in a case, and some worms were seen at the bottom of the case. So they called me to x-ray it, and the x-ray showed something sort of interesting, to say the least. Now, all these tiny segments, black, dark segments, those are tunnels of the worms eating up the wood and some of the paint as well. Now, so what those two red rectangles showed, a comparison that I made with the two x-rays in time and check what came out. In 1983, in that small region, I could see the worm right here. In 2001, well, the worm was long gone and obviously eating up his way out. And that, you know, this simple comparison, x-raying a painting in time, they don't do it. It's easy, straightforward, it's not done. Why? The methodology is not there. All right, but let's see some good side. X-rays of paintings can also bring you new knowledge. Look at this Madonna by Beccafumi in the Museum of Pinacotec of Siena. And just x-raying it, it gives you an understanding that there is an interesting history here. The baby originally was on the right-hand side of the Madonna. And that gives you the evolution. Now, that is, as I say, bread for art historians, because then they can see, study the style, the anatomy, the physiognomy, and see if they could have been done by the same artist or not, in addition to do analysis, cross-section analysis, chemical analysis, to define if the technique to paint the two babies were the same or not. Now let's move up and let's go to Leonardo again. And here we are in the Uffizi, in the Sala of Leonardo, in the Leonardo's room. And I brought a bunch of equipment and some young engineers to analyze the Annunciation. Now, maybe it sounds so straightforward. It's not for me. You get the permission because you have spent a lifetime knocking at doors and museums, showing that what you're doing is worth doing it, not because you say, but because the results you get and you provide in the interest of the conservation and preservation of the work of art. That's how you gain a ticket to ride, to get in and to study a masterpiece like that. Why? Because it has not been studied before. We don't know how that painting was made. Leonardo paintings, maybe 12, 13, some historians say 14. I don't believe 14, maybe even less than 10. But in any case, hardly we know how Leonardo painted. We do not know because science has not yet had a chance to study those masterpieces. Just only four. So now let's see some finding. And it's not over. The study is not over. But I took young engineers from here over there to study the Annunciation. That's what I call on-site training of young engineers, and the experience they gain, the emotion they get. Where do you get it? They will remember all their life long. And yet, they will provide essential data. So, look. Now we're looking at the pseudocolor infrared again, and you can see the red, which is and the green in this case. On you have vermilion. The gown of the angel was red, and when it turns in yellow, it shows the presence of vermilion. And here, lapis lazuli again. So it's all fine. Now you get in one shot a sort of palette of colors. And you see where the distribution of, in this case, just a couple of colors, but we can do better than that without, it's a non-invasive. And now let's go deeper in trying to analyze something that has now been either shown or even published. Most of the work that I'm showing you, by the way, has not been published yet. Especially the images of the Primavera face. And you wonder why. So let's see the angels at the Madonna's face. Now, first the X-ray underneath, and this sort of dark halo shows that there was a face first laid out, and then has been scraped off because that is the part of the preparatory layer, the priming, that has been taken out, and then the face has been repainted. And this is the original layer of the priming. You see all those cracks? Because there was a problem of too much oil and too fast the drying, and so it's just cracked open, as well as you can see some these tiny white dots are the exit holes of worms that ate their way through, ate the pigment as well, and then those holes were filled in with gesso. That's why they show white in X-rays. But now, let's go and see another feature, to say the least, that you would not expect. And again, not with your eyes. Now look. You might see some bluish stuff here on the skin, especially in the neck. That bluish stuff that you see better on along the hair, that's all repaint. A very heavy repaint, trust me. Basically, everywhere you find repaint on the Annunciation. Now, that repaint, you can call it restoration. You can call it a sort of a second skin. Now, remember that at that time means not in recent times. Now we see the same thing in the angel. Painting over was sort of straightforward, was a way to restore it. Now the X-ray of the angel shows a double profile of the forehead, as well as you can see that the forehead here, the area, as it shows a totally different radiopacity, showing that there was indeed a first layout of the face of the angel painted with tempera, that is egg, as a binding media, rather than oil, as it is the rest of the face with a much more lead white mixed with it. But then, look this. This is a beautiful image of the underdrawing, especially of the hair. These beautiful hair are being drawn, and you can see also some of the drawing here in the forehead. So we can deep go through and see all the way to the preparation layer and see the drawing, the preparatory drawing, the first idea transformed into a line, a sign. And here, pseudocolor again, that shows you the same repaints on the wing, on the hair, on the face, It's basically like a second skin, and that's what we are looking when we go to the Uffizi. So maybe we should just pay attention that maybe we can be fooled by our eyes. Simply, we need to know how things are and where and how they were changed in time. Now, showing the top X-ray image and the Cyprus detail, look what it comes out. We zoom in and we keep going, and now you see fingerprints here and here and here. It's full of fingerprints. Now you can say, Leonardo fingerprints? I don't know. All I know is that I found many fingerprints with X-rays, by the way. So if you find fingerprints with X-rays, it means, and they're not visible to the naked eye, it means that those fingerprints are under the color layer, so those are from that time when the painting was made. That's an interesting other investigation, sort of CSI, that we will work in the future. Now, let's move on to another very important patient, the Adoration of the Magi. This is where we worked, very tiny place, and very important painting. But nevertheless, it was a great experience, a great honor. So, this is a very big painting. It's the biggest, as a matter of fact, that Leonardo has ever painted on wood, or we call it as a mobile painting rather than mural. And is sitting at the Uffizi, and really has given us a great, great gift, because under that monochrome layer, we found these incredible drawings that I know some of you have seen. Frankly, every time I see them, well, it's a privilege for me, because it's beauty at the highest form that Leonardo finally has revealed to us, thanks to science, to understand, to peer through, to really show how that work of art was created. So, let's start seeing some beautiful, extremely beautiful drawings of animals. So now, this is the way you see it, well, sort of, if you go to the Uffizi. But this is really what Leonardo has shown us. Look at this. Has been sitting there for 5 centuries. Let's move on and see another beautiful, another couple of heads of horses, which you hardly can recognize anything here, because that monochrome was not Leonardo, by the way. We managed to prove that all that stuff sitting on it has been added later by a second artist. But if you go to the Uffizi, it still says Leonardo da Vinci, and they don't tell you anything about what is underneath, or they don't show you anything about this incredible, beautiful drawing. But we can do it here. And look at these beautiful horses. Look at this. And all this figures here, these portraits, these profiles, it shows emotions, motion, and action. And again, another one, another animal, to say the least, very unusual for the ones of you who has not seen it, is still a surprise. Look what is sitting there. Okay? An elephant. Why? And not only the elephant, but also the you've seen that pole and that roof? That's the manger. So the elephant. An elephant, because this is not only the Adoration, but also the Epiphany. And so a story, as I mentioned other times, in time and space. It's an incredible, intricate story, beautiful, beautifully rendered in over 60 figures never seen before. Now we have the privilege to see it here. And look, it's not over. Look, this beautiful head. I don't have another word to say it, but it's really emotional for me to see Leonardo at work like this. And as it's coming out, almost out of nowhere. Look, this is the Leonardo we know. And again, no one has ever thought all this was underneath. It's not over. look, this incredible, this couple of horses and horsemen, look, you have several positions of the arm. This figure here that shows the fear to be crushed and killed, and the tangled legs of the horses, they are fighting against each other, even the horses. It's really, and you see the head of the horse that is trying to escape, to run away, doesn't want to see the blood and the fear and the battle scene. And look at the other one. It's even more expressive. You see two heads here of the horse. Look this profile. It looks the anger, ready to kill other horse's head. Why the head? Because this is the line of the horizon. So we see not just two horsemen fighting, but actually we see a real battle scene spread in a much larger area. And and look, several positions of the rear legs of the horse and the left leg of the horseman. So everything is moving, everything is action. It's a real war. But this is supposed to be the adoration, something peaceful, something that you don't expect any violence. This could be a reason why he never finished, because probably the poor priest, actually they were friars, when they saw something like this, I can imagine how they could have said, no way, we don't want this. And he left, and he never came back to finish this job. And the friars waited for him 15 years before they decided finally to call another artist and say, would you please make a normal adoration of the Magi, which, by the way, is sitting at the Uffizi as well. And I guess they were happy about it. But now look, this incredible sequence of laymen reconstructing the temple from ruins, totally changing the idea, the iconology of that part of the painting, where otherwise you could see just destruction and pessimism and disillusion, waiting for the Christ to come in a world with no hope. Instead, it's all emotion. It's all reconstructing. So again, not only we understand the story, but also we understand and we see a totally different story. Now look at this figure. It's so beautiful, so Leonardesque, if you can accept my word or this definition, right here. Look. Look, everything is so transparent. It melts, their gown with a flock of hairs, and it's so expressive. Yet it's probably one of the very few figures that is sort of standing, not moving too much. And to finish with the sequence, I'd like to show you what I have said several times. I know, but after all, I not only enjoy that, but really I feel privileged to see something like you're going to see now. This was supposed to be, has been defined as a worn-out area, nothing there. And they wanted to clean it up. And this has been the only time in 36 years that I do this job, the only time when I managed to stop the restorers and prevent them from touching this painting, because it's extremely too delicate, they would have damaged the underdrawing. Because, for the reason I show you, I didn't want to see another Primavera story again. And now I show you why. Look, the incredible, beautiful collection of portraits right there. You cannot find anything like that in all art history. Each of them, as I said over and over, it's really a masterpiece on its own. And now look, just some of these faces blown up. Look at this. This is what we would like to see. And I've been fighting sort of It's a way of saying it, because, you know, it's not that I can win that fight, but try to convince, I should rather say, the Uffizi to show all this next to the painting. Because this is the real Leonardo, not what you see with your eyes when you go to the Uffizi. And eventually, I had finally, after 35 years, November 17th of last year, I had the chance to show all this incredible contribution of Leonardo magic, Leonardo creativity, in the Hall of the 500. And this guy is the mayor, and the president of the National Geographic Society was here, and this was an international audience. It was a great honor for me. Finally, I was like, all this was accepted, but it took, if you consider that this work, I've done it 8 years ago. It took me 8 years. Keep pushing. Finally, now all these people have been confronted. They had a chance to see what kind of incredible masterpiece is hidden there. And you should have seen the audience, how they reacted. Full of museum directors from all over the world, by the way. All right, but we do great things also at San Diego, and the digital clinical chart of a work of art is one of those projects that really we should be proud of, because it's the first time as a concept that we apply this concept to works of art. Sounds obvious? It's not. Surely has never been done before. So we developed not only the technology, but also we developed the methodology, and we're trying to introduce this methodology so that every work of art in a museum should have a clinical chart. And this clinical chart should be updated in time with proper technology and methodology, like you would do with a patient in a hospital. And don't just write down the name of the work of art alone and pretend that that's all you get in terms of understanding what you're dealing with. So it's true that it's the first time, and a clinical chart is like in the medicine, in the medical field. That is, you have the anamnesis, and then you have imaging diagnostics and analytical diagnostics, and then you have the final report, the report, that is the diagnosis. That's more or less what we've been trying to do. And look, this is just to give you an example of what multispectral imaging is all about. Apply different wavelengths to generate at different depths, different understanding, visual understanding of how the work of art was generated, the genesis of the painting. And this is just multispectral imaging. And after that, we move in with analytical diagnostics to identify, to characterize pigments and materials. In other words, we introduce objective methodology and generating objective data, because that is the base of real conservation. Otherwise, conservation is just restoration, because basically that's what out there is done or is considered. So to make conservation a real science, you need a scientific approach and not just handwork. And we've done the same with the David by Michelangelo. And after a laser scanning, we went through and analyzed some of the weak spots. Now, the David is a gigantic statue. It's sitting on the pedestal, very high pedestal. Now, in this area here, you can see there are fractures. This is another fight that I'm going through with the museum director. I keep asking, let me do the gamma radiography, because so I can see how deep, together with ultrasound scanning, how deep those cracks go. Because if we have an earthquake, we don't know. It could collapse. After all, Florence and the whole region is a seismic region. But then, for them, it's more important that the statue is clean, as has been recently cleaned. But what about those very scary lines or fractures? Now, I'd like to show you two very short clips about some other achievements that we have made at CISA 3. One deals with hyperspace wall, and the other one is the multi-touch table. What you will see is unique. You can find it only here so far. Hopefully we will inspire other museums or other research centers to do the same. I think it's a big contribution, and for the means we have, it's almost a miracle. Now, let me launch this very
This
brief.
Renaissance Madonna and Child by Carlo Crivelli has been photographed and scanned using a variety of technologies at UC San Diego's Center of Interdisciplinary Science for Art, Architecture, and Archaeology. Engineers have also devised new and easier ways to display the results. They call it extreme visualization. This hyperspace wall at 287 million pixels, one of the world's highest resolution display systems, so many pixels that you can still zoom in and see the finest detail. And because different scans can be calibrated and draped over other images, viewers move seamlessly from the visible layer photograph deep into other layers captured using different techniques or wavelengths of light, from visible to raking light, ultraviolet fluorescence, reflected UV, pseudocolor infrared, near-infrared, IR reflectography, and X-radiography, X-rays. Researchers in San Diego have also deployed the newest generation of tile display walls made of ultra-narrow bezel 46-inch flat screens, dramatically reducing the French door effect of earlier display systems. Researchers have also developed easy-to-use software for wiping between sections of a painting as they look for telltale clues about its history. The tiniest features may not be visible in one type of scan, but can appear suddenly at longer or shorter wavelengths. These technologies are already reshaping the world of art conservation. Gradually, they will also become available to museum visitors, even on the internet, now that virtual reality can offer new insight about the reality of art history and how to safeguard our cultural heritage. The HyperTouch table is a multi-touch surface developed by Kevin Ponto in the visualization lab of Professor Falco Kuster in collaboration with UC San Diego Center of Interdisciplinary Science for Art, Architecture, and Archaeology and its director, Maurizio Saracini. It puts versatile interactive visualization at the viewer's fingertips, literally, permitting exploration of artworks in great detail, not only on the surface, but what lies beneath the surface. After a complete diagnostic survey of Leonardo da Vinci's Adoration of the Magi, the multispectral images were uploaded to the HyperTouch table, allowing anyone to explore the masterpiece's state of conservation and the techniques that Leonardo used. Pressing fingers on the surface can reveal the back of the wood panel. Then the X-ray can appear. Then fluorescence generated by ultraviolet light, which can uncover stray dust on the surface of a painting. And in this case, infrared light uncovering the true masterpiece, Leonardo's underdrawing, not seen in nearly 500 years. The detailed preparatory drawing was covered over with brownish paint, likely by another artist, as indicated by pseudocolor infrared imaging and other tests. Under that brownish coat, now visible to anyone who can wipe away the past, are stunning secrets, like the previously invisible workman depicted rebuilding a pagan temple. Also hidden for half a millennium, one of the most spectacular collections of faces ever drawn by Da Vinci. Now imagine putting the HyperTouch table at the fingertips of medical students. This is a volumetric rendering of the CAT scan of a human head. It can be moved around, enlarged, and with just their fingers, students can explore the inside of the skull. The harder you press, the deeper you go. just by rubbing the skin down to the skull, reaching the eye sockets or lips giving way to show teeth. Many other wavelengths could be added, making the multi-touch table a powerful tool for learning and for discovery in medicine, in art conservation, and conceivably in many other fields as well. In other words, a fitting tool that would make Leonardo da Vinci, the true Renaissance man, very proud.
Well, the commentary and this incredible voice is by Doug Ramsey right here. And you have seen that's what we call real interaction with a work of art. Finally, not being passive, not going to a museum and just viewers that don't have any interaction, don't have any way to really understand and to really know, to really be curious, to learn something. But just look and move. Look and move. Read a label and go. That's not a way that you create a future for our past. That's not a way that you create any link with the new generations with their past. Because there is no way that they can understand why that, rather than the other one, is a real masterpiece. What is there to understand, to discover? Why is so interesting? Why is a masterpiece? Again, technology can help us do this. And again, we are developing these very tools right here. And this will change the way museums will operate very soon. Because we need to understand, we need, if we want to, not only to appreciate, but if we want to care for our past, for our culture. Now, the Battle of Anghiari issue is a big one. As you know, I've been after this for a long time, since 1975, believe it or not, and this is the place where the action is it's happening right now in the Hall of the 500. It's an incredible place where somewhere, or actually by now we know where, Leonardo da Vinci in 1503, 1505, he painted this huge mural, the Battle of Anghiari, depicting or celebrating, I should rather say, a victory of the Republic of Florence, the army of the Republic of Florence, over the Milanese. This fight was fought in 1440 in the plains of Anghiari, not too far from Arezzo, a city half an hour from Florence. This is an incredible sight, and the way you see it has been transformed by Vasari. But let's go step by step, even though at a faster pace, as I've been told, where you see how Leonardo da Vinci in 1478 already had in mind this fighting scene, that he kept thinking about it until he had a chance to put it on a wall in 1503. And as a matter of fact, if you go through this monochrome layer and you see those two horsemen, as if you recall, as we saw before, now you can see a reminiscence of this concept in this later copy by Rubens, who was copying another an original drawing, a contemporary drawing of the made at the time when the Battle of Anghiari was visible. And this is what we are looking for, the central piece of the Battle of Anghiari, the fight for the standard. Well, way back then in 1975, when I was trying to find my way through this incredible task, using ultrasounds to scan the surface of the plaster, or I should say the Vasari mural, because I was told to search right under the Vasari mural. So I used ultrasounds in 1975 when ultrasounds were not yet applied into the medical world, at least in Italy, on a steady manner. And, well, obviously we did not find anything because that was not the way, or I should say that's not where we should have been looking for. And later we learned that we had to look for something under the wall that was supporting the Vasari's mural. But something, it came out in 1975 and was a flag with an inscription, Cerca trova, search you shall find. And that was, to say the least, very curious. But then from 1505 all the way to 1560, when Vasari, the architect that was commissioned by Cosimo Primo to renew the hall of the 500, well, throughout that length of time, many copies were made of the Battle of Anghiari. Here you see one by Rubens, as we already had a look, and then several others, anonymous artists, not only, but we found a lot of documents of diaries and eyewitness accounts. So the Battle of Anghiari was not only visible, but was very much appreciated. And we recently, this is another copy, and look what we did find here under this drawing, just a drawing, okay? Using again an infrared camera, we found a date, 1553, which tell us that until a few years before Vasari started to remodel, indeed there were artists coming and copying this masterpiece, so the masterpiece was not destroyed. So as I said, Vasari came in, commissioned by the Grand Duke Cosimo Primo de' Medici, and Vasari was a great admirer of Leonardo. So that's when the Battle of Anghiari disappeared in the Hall of the 500. What happened to it? Well, we do know, though, that Vasari was not only an admirer, but every time he had, every chance he had, he saved masterpieces such as, for example, this one here, by Masaccio, the Trinity by Masaccio, which is to be seen today in the Church of Santa Maria Novella, was saved, placing a brick wall just in front of it and leaving a small air gap. So we said, well, maybe Vasari has done the same in the Hall of the 500, so we searched for an air gap, but first we had to do an entire rendering, 3D modeling of the Palazzo Vecchio and especially of the Hall of the 500, and this was an incredible task, never attempted before, with a precision of 1 centimeter, which would have taken years and years and years if you had done it manually. So that was one of the first time when laser scanning was used for this purpose. And then we used thermography or thermoimaging to understand and to visualize what could have been hidden behind plaster walls. Here, just one example only, but to give you an idea how far we went in pushing technologies already existent. But here you see all the windows that were dated 1299, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And so this way we were able to see wall after wall, room after room, and understand how this gigantic hall was transformed by Vasari, and then understand where Leonardo da Vinci could have painted, where there were the empty rooms, empty space, I should say, where he could have placed his masterpiece. And as we said, then I reconstructed also the original staircase, because we found a document saying that once you get on top of the staircase, have a look in front of you, you'll see the wonderful horses of Leonardo. And we managed to find the original staircase. There was another contribution. As well as then we decided to use radar scanning, never done before, on a wall. And we managed to find, indeed, an air gap. And this is where we found it. Right here on the east side, east wall, on the right-hand side, this is an overall thermal imaging of the entire wall, which is over 200 feet long. It took, I don't remember how many nights of work just to assemble thousands of thermograms just to generate this image alone that shows, as we had stripped down all the plaster, all the murals, and see what Vasari did to change the structure. And on top of that, we did the scanning, and we generate a map that indicates clearly that over here was indeed an air gap. Only there, throughout the whole of the 500. And this is where we believe the Battle of Anghiari centerpiece should be located. And this is a rendering taken out from Channel 4 documentary that gives an idea that is behind the wall set up by Vasari when he painted his murals. He first plastered, or I should say built, a brick wall, and on top of it, which then he painted. And that brick wall is actually hiding, but leaving a near small air gap, the masterpiece behind by Leonardo da Vinci. Now, what we are at, finally we have done, as you have seen in the trailer initially, we have done some good homework and to understand that finally how we can go through a brick wall and detect organic materials. Why? Because Leonardo did use oil. So if we send neutrons and we get those neutrons back scattered to you, we know that that could be related to the hydrogen content in the wall, which in turn is tied to the organic materials such as oil. We tested that with several panels painted with oil and colors, a different percentage of oil, placing those panels behind the brick wall, and we could indeed detect not only the oil, or I should say the hydrogen associated to the oil, but different percentages. And then the next step was, okay, how do we go to detect the pigments? Well, we know which pigments Leonardo has used, because we know from an original document. So we also know the chemical composition, the chemical elements, and that's what we're looking for. How we do this? Sending neutrons, at this time collecting the gamma rays that are generated by the colliding neutrons with the atoms of the different chemical elements, and then we do a spectra analysis, and then we understand if indeed not only that element is associated to the pigment, to a pigment, but also where it's located, because we now have a way to triangle, so to speak, even though we do this with what is called time of flight, where that gamma rays is, which depth is coming from. So we will not be misunderstood. When we pick up a gamma ray, not to be misunderstood where it's coming from the Leonardo mural rather than from the Vasari mural. All right, then another project we are involved in is Palazzo Medici Riccardi, as I mentioned to you, and this is the kind of work we are doing, where from a 3D rendering, laser rendering, then we can do the thermal imaging of each wall, then assembly everything, and then walk through literally in space and time, as here briefly as is shown, where you have on top and the bottom the way you see it today, rather than just looking under this plaster wall and the decoration. So this is the future also for conservation, for real conservation of monuments, not letting to the architects to know better and to intervene with monuments without knowing what they're doing, because they don't have that know-how, not because they're not architects, but because they cannot see with their eyes only. Here you see the structure, you see the changes, you see the architectural elements. So you can plan your intervention, you can plan your restoration with true know-how, objective know-how, which will respect the integrity of the monument and its own history. And again, two more examples. Look, this would be impossible to touch a wall like that decorated with golden lilies, but yet the structure can tell you a lot about all the problems here in terms of cracks. And actually, this is a flue, and here is a big door that we found, original big, from the 13th century. So not only we can retrace the history of the monument and the transformation went through, but also the weak spot, structurally speaking. But we can do the same on the modern buildings, such as this one here. We see all the beams, the reinforced concrete beams structure. And so we can plan, we can make an assessment of the behavior of a seismic activity, because we have an objective understanding, a real image, not a theoretical behavior. as well as other application, Hagia Sophia. This could be a lecture on its own another time. I've been there a couple of times. There are wonderful mosaics. And UC Radar, we found a lot of other mosaics. Those are the most beautiful Christian mosaics ever, way much better than we have in Italy, in San Vitale, Ravenna, and so forth, because that was the St. Peter of the Orient. And also, we help checking some of the failures, in this case, water seepage from the roof tiles of this incredible monument. And here you can see how we were able to spot seepage of rain water coming through the roof, and they appreciate it a lot because this was really creating a big problem in terms of not only the structure but also the fast decay of all the plaster as well as the mosaics underneath. Now in archaeology, very fast, a lot can be done. Why do we think we associate archaeology with digging? Who said that? Why that should be the only way to understand what is under the ground? Well, we have an association not only with National Geographic, but also with people like Sadi Awas, who is now, by the way, the Minister of Cultural Heritage of Egypt. And just using ground-penetrating radar, geoelectric survey, geomagnetic survey, just check yourself how much we can find out. And here is a rendering, right here, of the finding with geo radar. These are actually profiles under the ground of a small city. Without touching anything, you actually have the precise assessment of what is there, which depth, and what is the shape. But the same goes for geoelectric. This is the shape of a church. This is the full shape of the church, which is just on this part of the ground. And indeed, that was another finding never thought of in that area. And this is an example of the geoelectric. Look, it looks like a picture. It looks like a black and white picture, but those are all hidden structures under the ground. Very precise, very clear, without touching the ground. And they, again, geomagnetic, studying the changes of magnetic, the magnetic shift of the ground. Look here. This is a wall around a small village, very thick wall. Again, it looks like a picture. Okay, it's the way we should assess if the site is really interesting for archaeological digging later, after we know where and what is there. And going to my great colleague, Professor Levy, the archaeologist and anthropologist, then he set up this Mediterranean Archaeological Network to collect all the data in a cyber infrastructure of the archaeological finding in the Mediterranean basin, as well as searching for the Solomon mines, which with new tools such as, for example, balloon that can take pictures from the top and really get a first assessment of the site, that sometimes you get lost, especially in a desert area like that. Or look, this finding, which is I find very intriguing. We are looking through a 3D rendering and a walkthrough of one area of the Solomon mines, and it's called the guard gate. Unfortunately, it doesn't start, but it was a nice walkthrough generated by first a laser scanning of the entire area and it put in motion, as well as you see here some dating, archaeological dating at different depths, and so introducing also objective dating, not just made by shapes of object rather than hypothesis, historical hypothesis. And then we have Albert Lin, our new scientist who has envision this crowdsourcing, a way to use satellite imaging and give it to the public so that each of them can study a small part of this very high-resolution satellite imaging to help spotting, in this case in Mongolia, some features that could suggest later, as he has done it, with three missions in Mongolia, where to go by, because Mongolia is huge, and finally the Genghis Khan tomb, to say the least, is a big job. And so this crowdsourcing really was had a very big success, and through the help of National Geographic. But not only, Albert Lin was instrumental also in setting up what we call a UCSD National Geographic Engineers for Exploration Program. That is, we are associated to National Geographic to engineer solutions for their explorers when they go on site in different parts of the world. That's a privilege. It's never happened before. Never happened that National Geographic go to any universities to find for these solutions. And this is very exciting for students, especially young engineers, young engineering student. And just to summarize this unique partnership, so we have not only support for some of the project expeditions that CISA 3 is involved in, since we are, most of us, we are awarded by National Geographic, but also we are engaged with them to produce documentaries, for example. They're following step by step the search for the Battle of Anghiari. They will come up with an hour and a half documentary. And that documentary will go in 160 countries. And that's how you put UCSD on the map. As well as I mentioned to you, we are the provider, the preferred provider of technology solutions for them. Now, we are the final stretch, okay? So we'll make my friend, I know, he's telling me, cut your head off. But you have to allow me to show you the new discovery. This is something that really is worth looking at it and has taken me quite a lot of time. Now, the name of the game is Medusa by Caravaggio, okay? I'm sure you heard about this work of art. Medusa by Caravaggio, the lady with all the snakes. All right? The Medusa by Caravaggio is the Uffizi. You go to the Uffizi, you see the Medusa by Caravaggio. Okay. How about if we were to challenge that? You mean, what do you mean challenging that? Well, here's what I'm going to show you. Fast, okay? Promise. This is not the Medusa by Caravaggio. This is another Medusa, exactly looking the same. And you say, well, so what? Somebody has copied it. Wait. Let's go further. So, this is the Medusa that has been studied scientifically, step after step, and this is the Medusa at the Uffizi. So it's bigger, as you can see. But it's exactly the same. All right. Now, I went through a lot of exams, trust me, step by step, as I've done with all the other masterpieces I've examined. I also examined the Medusa at the Uffizi. Now, the Medusa, both of them are painted over a convex shield. Now, how do you think an artist, Caravaggio, any other artist, could paint on a convex surface? A painting so intricate, so difficult, with all the snakes going everywhere, without a drawing, a sketch, a sign, a geometric reference, a grid, whatever. Not only that, in the Uffizi, there is no underdrawing. First. Second, in the one of the Uffizi, no changes in the painting layer, not even of a tiny change of for a snake. And if you see the X-ray, absolutely, it's like a picture taken and plastered over. So you wonder, wait a minute, how was possible? How you do something like that? on a convex surface. All right, let's go and see what this other guy has to say. So, this is what it comes out. This is what you find under the second Medusa. A real drawing and a real sketchwork, reworked and reworked. Why? Because it's a convex surface. It's a shield. It's such an intricate pattern given by the snakes, the expression, everything. So that's what you would expect. Let's see some details. Look. Not only you have the drawing, sketch, several drawings, several sketches, but also you have, look, eyes, pattern, a completely first layout, and then he changed it again. A sort of a first monochrome layout before he even attempted to put real final colors. You don't find that in the Uffizi Medusa. Again, look at the mouth. Again, you see an artist creating, working, shaping, finding the right solution, the right form, the right shape. The first version had even hair. Not over. And look at this. And even some of the snakes with infrared, the pseudo color, you can see this sort of reddish parts here were attempted. So we have a monochrome first layer paint before even attempted to say, okay, now I know what I'm going to do. So how all this was done? Well, first of all, you have to cut thin strips of wood to assemble with strips of wood just mounted and crossing each other and fixed to a round ring, sort of a metal ring, so that you could bend them with putting water on it and slowly bend them to shape them like a shield, and then you actually nail them together. This was found in both paintings, by the way, the same technique, same wood. All right, and then you put a priming over the wood support, as well as then after that, over the priming, you put a canvas on one side and the other side, and you set, as you see, these are some of the nails that go through, and then they're bent over to fix the strips of the wood all together. Same technique in both paintings. And then first, both of them were completed with the hand grip of the shield, which is this one here. So imagine both of them were done the same way. Same carpentry, same finishing behind it, same hand grip. So it looks like they came from the same workshop. And then with this new Medusa, then the drawing, and then this monochrome painting first, and then the final paint. Now, and then what happened? How you paint the other one without making any change? Well, we had to work a lot to understand that. Look, if you put a glass on top of the first Medusa, you can paint on a flat screen the overall layout from the painting, the finished painting. And then how you transfer that over the second shield? Well, that's how you do it. And we tested it. And not only this works, but this indeed we found it in documents as a way to transfer one image on from one surface to another. Candlelight, projecting it, and then you paint over. Okay? This was tested. It did work this way. So now you have the first Medusa and the second Medusa, which happens to be with no drawing because there was no need. No pentimenti, no changes. There was no need. He could paint exactly, precisely. The second one is the Uffizi. The first one is coming out in a matter of a couple months with a book. So art historians will have enough to scratch their head, which is part of their fun, right? And so this is the first one, and this is the second one, still by the same artist. We're not talking about, another artist, no. But we now know that this one of the Uffizi could have not been the original one. So imagine how art historians will love us, especially the ones that are very expert on Caravaggio, and they've written a bunch of books. Now we are at the final stretch, promised, the last three. But this one is what I wanted to show you. The house, the palace of Amerigo Vespucci, that's where we have been given an entire floor by the region of Tuscany for the next 10 years, for free. No one, 38 universities in Florence, never got this free ride. We did. We have it. And this is where we'll showcase UCSD worldwide. This is where we can really have access, bring students, do training, field training on masterpieces, as well as we have been requested by the region of Tuscany, to also do and share research with in the field of medicine and biotechnologies with the region of Tuscany. Having access, in addition, to regional funds as well as EU money, because we will be there. Now that's what I call a real asset for UCSD as a whole. And in the heart of the Renaissance, in the house of Amerigo Vespucci, and next year, Italy and the States are celebrating the 500th anniversary of the birth of Amerigo Vespucci. It's not a bad idea, and it's not a bad deal for us, don't you think? So I hope that this will go through. Why do I say that? Well, because we are in the process of finishing up some bureaucratic step here locally. But we have already the region giving us the place. So what we are here for, basically what I came here for, well, really to train a generation of scholars and to create a new discipline which is unique. You will not find another university worldwide, I can assure you, that has this kind of program. And I hope, I want to see the day when we will offer a degree in engineering applied to cultural heritage, because we will be the first one, and that's how we also can get on the world map. And we should be seriously evaluating this huge possibility together with all that you have seen that is our disposal. Especially in a moment like this, when money is scarce, there is crisis, let's face it, we need ideas. We need to be bold. And it's not only that, but we also are doing something just as important than putting UCSD on the world map, which is, in addition, we are rediscovering, basically, the spirit of the Renaissance, and not yet. There is more. Our contribution is really to create a future of our past. Now, when I was a student, I learned directly from our founding fathers, and I tried to put it in my words, to offer a truly interdisciplinary education. blending science and technology, that's what I've been taught, with the arts and humanities to face the growing complexities, then imagine today, of a culturally heterogeneous society in a globalized world that now it's even way much more than before. Now, we are trying to follow the principles of our founding fathers because this is what we are driven by. And this is a way to honor, in my opinion, UCSD and the founding principles of UCSD. And this is what I've been told to put it at the last one. This is not culture heritage, but I will definitely ask for your support. This is not just for one project. This is not just for a person. This is not for a professor. This is for us. And I really hope that we can count on your support, and we can promise you that once we're in Florence, we're all invited, and I mean it, to come and I'll give you a personal tour of Florence, the way I can see Florence. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.